This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
I'm delighted that we have such a big audience for this event. It should be a really interesting conversation. What I'm going to do is ask Bill some questions for 20 to 30 minutes and then throw it open to questions from you. And we'll end at 1 because I know that many of you have places you have to be at 1. So I really enjoyed this book. I found it extraordinarily stimulating. Sometimes I felt like arguing with it. Other times I thought, absolutely, absolutely. Your book has two subtitles, The Miseducation of the American Elite and The Way to a Meaningful Life. And it seems to me it has two arguments. And I wonder, for those in the room that haven't read the book, if you could characterize those two arguments.
Yeah, I think the easiest way to do that is to give a very short genealogy of the book.
That's
I wrote
great.
An essay that came out in 2008. It happened to be right at the time that I was leaving not only Yale but academia, called The Disadvantages of an Elite Education. Mm-hmm. I would have given it a better title if I thought anyone was actually going to read it. But it was about, I mean, it was really about the way the admissions process distorted the students that I saw at Yale. It inculcates careerism and credentialism rather than intellectualism or the development of a sense of purpose. I mean, that puts it in a nutshell. I wasn't the first to mount critiques of the meritocracy. Nicholas Lehman in The Big Test, his history mm-hmm. of the SAT, talks about the risk aversion and empty ambition mm-hmm. that the system produces, and others have echoed that critique. And I didn't think anyone would see it, really. It ended up coming out of The American Scholar, which is a publication I've been writing for and love for a long time, but not a lot of people read it. And I figured it was going to sink without a trace. And what happened instead is that, like, literally the fourth day it posted online, it started to circulate among elite college students and recent graduates. And I started to get hundreds of emails, and ultimately the piece was read well over a million times. But it wasn't even like a million in a month. It was a million over year after year after year after year. Like, even when the book came out 6 years later, it was still being read 10,000 times a month. And it was being read by that community. It was circulating in that demographic. Because apparently, I had given voice to the dissatisfactions of those students. And the emails all said, thanks for giving voice to my dissatisfactions. Thanks for talking about in public what I only think about. And I thought I was the only person. So then the other thing that happened, like, the next day, was that I started to be invited to campuses. The first talk was at Harvard in that fall, and then the next day I drove to Cornell and I gave another talk. And it was an ongoing dialogue. And so the original essay was really critique, and it wasn't directed at students. It was sour and angry, mm-hmm. as I often am. Uh-huh. And so I would say two things. It still resonated with them despite the barrier that represented. And then the other thing is that at those events and in the emails, the things that students always ask me was, what should I do about this? What should we do? But also, like, what should I do? I know I'm trapped in the system. Mm-hmm. What do I do about it? So that ended up being the other half of the book and the second mm-hmm. half of the subtitle. It's actually the middle half of the book. It's parts yeah. 2 and 3. Mm-hmm. So The Miseducation of the American Elite is the critique and The Way to a Meaningful Life. I know it sounds kind of self-helpy, but listen, authors never write their titles. But also, you know, I sort of embrace self-help in the sense that, like, no one else is giving them help. So they need to help themselves, and I'm trying to help them help themselves. It's a book that has a divided argument. It also has a divided audience.
Yeah.
And I'm conscious of that. I knew, in a sense, it's a flaw in the book. I often address students, and I address them in the second person. Mm. Second person singular, if there were a second person singular. Like, I'm talking to you as an individual because whatever the grown-ups do, you need to save yourself from the system. And then I'm also addressing the grown-ups, which means sometimes it's parents, sometimes it's people at universities, because we should try to change the system. So it's not so hard for students to get a meaningful education and find a sense of purpose in life.
So as I was reading the first of your books, the critique of Ivy League education, I kept thinking, the students that I taught at Berkeley when I was on the faculty here, the students that I taught at Smith and got to know in many different contexts at Smith weren't like that. I kept not recognizing their faces in the mirror that you were holding up to them. They were quirky. They had a lot of rough edges. They were passionate about many things. And I was then very glad to see that you were recommending to students in the part of your book that's to students, go to a public university, go to a liberal arts college. You'll find more passionate engagement with the life of the mind and just with life in general at those places. What is it, if you accept the fact that students in these kinds of institutions are different and, you know, their general character, what is it about different kinds of institutions that nurtures or fosters or selects for different students?
Well, let me say, first of all, that I want to break down those sharp lines. And I know that in the book, I'm drawing them, and it's partly rhetorical, and I sort of qualify it. Uh-huh. And it's partly that I've learned more in the last year, and I think one of the main things that I've learned in the last year is that the system I describe as belonging not just to the Ivy League, but to selective private universities and maybe the most elite liberal arts colleges, like a place like Pomona, most of what I'm talking about is actually not only true across the American university system, but across education at all levels and in all countries. How's that for a big generalization? And the piece that I just published in Harper's a month ago really reflects that new awareness that this is really what education looks like in a neoliberal age, where students are thought of as human resources to be monetized and exploited by the corporate sector. And it's not selective college admissions per se. Still, I do think there are differences. I think there are institutional differences. And again, also saying that not every student at Yale is the same and there are exceptions and blah, blah, blah. There are institutional differences and there are institutional cultures. And last night, I spoke to the parents at Marin Academy, the private school in Marin County. And of course, they all want to know where should we send our kids. And I talked about how fit, it really is an important thing, even though it's become a cliche. And I think maybe the most important element of fit is the student culture. Like, don't go to a school that has an intensely pre-professional student culture. Liberal arts colleges tend to have a little bit more, and again, it depends on the school. I would never send anyone to Claremont McKenna. It's the worst place in the entire country.
But do we have any Claremont McKenna alums in this room?
But, you know, on the other hand, there's a place like Reed College, which I think has a real commitment to intellectualism. Student culture and of course, there's the whole issue of the culture of the faculty, right? I mean, liberal arts colleges do incentivize teaching a little bit better. When I recommended public universities, it was actually at a very specific juncture in the argument where I talk about socioeconomic diversity. I think public universities, and undoubtedly Berkeley, I mean, in some ways it's the least typical of all public universities, but I mean, we know that they tend to be very large institutions with large separations between faculties and students and a culture that's very much a research university culture, which means, I mean, Clark Kerr said this a long time ago, and I quote him in the book, concern for research is inversely proportional concern for teaching for teaching quality. Not even concern for teaching, to teaching quality. And we all know that. And we also know that in some ways it's a structural contradiction that we've never come to terms with.
But on the other hand, a place like Berkeley or all the UCs, a third of the upper division are community college transfers. So you get a very different student mix as a consequence of that. And so I'm not at all disputing what you're saying about teaching and the fact that universities like this one reward research more than teaching. But the student mix is really different for them. Student mix in the Ivy League, which I think makes a difference.
Right, and I think one of the most pernicious things, and the last section, as you know, is sort of a societal critique on how we've produced an elite in the image of these excellent sheep, and one characteristic of them is that they're totally cut off from the people who they've been given responsibility for, right? They're making the decisions for people that they've had almost no contact with throughout their entire lives if they went to elite private universities. And certainly I think that that's different at public universities.
So say somebody waved a magic wand and made you president of Yale tomorrow. What would you do put you on the Yale board? What would you recommend to change this? Are there changes that could happen short of some sweeping societal change would make things better?
Well, you see, that's the thing. I mean, I think I started this journey wanting, so to speak, to be president of Yale. I mean, not really, but I realized, like, that's actually that's, I mean, what I really want to be is like the czar of American education. And what I would do, and this is my big, this is my big recommendation. And since the book came out, I take every opportunity I can to say this. Mm-hmm. We need to go back to what Berkeley was before it's charged tuition, right? We need high quality, free, widely accessible public higher education.
Uh-huh.
And that means that the top 10%, not the top 1%, but the top 10%, which may include a lot of the people in this room, need to pay more in taxes.
Uh-huh.
That to me is the only systemic answer. There are probably things that places like Yale can do. I mean, we know that over the last 20 years, largely in response to congressional pressure, mm-hmm. the elite privates have made noises about opening up access.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an article that came out in the Times, I think it may have already been last year, maybe early this year, that said that after 20 years of trying, there's been no progress.
Mm-hmm.
Overall. There has been progress at some institutions, and I think Amherst is exemplary, and they've really made an effort, and they've really put resources into it, and they're like at the top of the table among private universities.
Yeah.
So whatever they're doing, I would do.
Yeah.
If I were president of Yale.
Interesting what they did, which is interesting in and of itself, is that they, it was when Tony Marks was president, and he knew he couldn't displace his traditional student constituency, so he made Amherst bigger and says all these slots are for Pell Grant kids.
Okay.
And
well, there you
Amherst
go.
Was rich and could do it.
Right.
And they had a passionate president who really cared about this and put his presidency on the line to do this. And so I suppose you could do the same thing. I mean, when the obvious admitted women, and I realize women aren't the same as socioeconomic diversity, but when they did it, that was essentially what they did. They got bigger. So they didn't have to displace the men.
Okay. I think that we need more leaders in American higher education like Tony Marks who are willing to actually... I mean, I see some of the people who've been president of Yale and other of those institutions, and they're just... There's no... You know, I think you can tell. There's no will or even desire to shake anything up, and they're sort of stewards of an increasingly global corporation.
So would we? But
let me just say again that ultimately, I don't think the Amherst, let alone the Yales, are the answer because their business model will always depend on having a lot of rich kids and producing a lot of rich alumni.
Yeah. So I think I can anticipate your answer to this question, but would Yale and Harvard and Dartmouth and Penn be better off if they established a kind of minimum cutoff for students who can do the work and just threw all the applications down the stairs and picked the class randomly? Do you think that would result in a change in this culture?
No. I don't think it's a bad idea, but you would still have to clear the bar.
Uh-huh.
And clearing the bar, makes kids, I mean, the level of psychological distress that's well documented, statistically documented, and written about by adolescent psychologists that the system produces is something we've never seen before. That wouldn't change. Mm-hmm. And the socioeconomic skew wouldn't change because it takes a lot of money to produce a kid who can clear the bar. That's the problem.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to switch topics and talk about employment for a bit. And the person who was last week, the center hosted Jamie Marisotis, the head of the Lumina Foundation, who is just to talk about his book that he's just published called America Needs Talent. And it was fascinating to be reading your books at the same time because they're both equally passionate. They're both offering a diagnosis of what's wrong with American higher education, but very, very different diagnoses. So Jamie feels that higher education has become unaccountable for its actual purpose. How much students learn, what students learn, and their preparation for their career, whatever that career is that they choose. So in higher education, as he would like to see it, this is a quote from his book, every student will know where he or she is going, how much it will cost to get there, how much time it will take, and what to expect at the journey's end, both in terms of learning outcomes and career prospects. So, admittedly, you're talking about different sectors of higher education. Jamie is very focused on community colleges, but would you what would you say in response to what Jamie says about what he wants for every student? This is one of the most powerful foundations in the higher education space, as you know.
I don't know the book, so I only know what you just read.
Yeah.
And so I may be wrong in saying that I agree with half of what he says. I think higher education has become really unaccountable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the tenured professoriate mainly is checked out. They have mm-hmm. no incentive to tune into anything that's going on. I think that the university system got fat and lazy and complacent during the boom years
mm-hmm.
and has had 40 years to adjust and in many ways hasn't. And sometimes I hear things that tenured people say or that people tell me they say, and I think, you know, it's France and it's 1788.
And
they're going to wake up one day and blood's going to be running in the streets and they're going to wonder what happened. And the answer is they happened.
Yeah.
Because they're so insulated that they haven't had to change. Now, the second half, I'm sure I radically disagree with him because he's one of the people, and they are the dominant voices in education. This is what I talk about, global neoliberal education.
Mm-hmm.
That the purpose of education is, as Scott Walker said, to meet the state's workforce needs, right?
Uh-huh.
That's how he wanted to rewrite the charter of the University of Wisconsin, meet the state's workforce needs.
Mm-hmm.
I was on a panel on Japanese television. You know, Japan wants to do away with the liberal arts,
mm-hmm.
like literally do away with the liberal mm-hmm. arts. How are we going to meet global workforce, global human resources?
Mm-hmm.
And I finally said, you know, students are not human resources to be exploited like oil or gas, to be
mm-hmm.
monetized. They're human beings, and that's
mm-hmm.
how we need to think of them.
Mm-hmm.
I think that students do need to know how much it's going to cost, and I do think that universities need to help in many ways. Community colleges maybe need to help bridge the gap between education and employment, but not in the way that he thinks. And the notion that you need to have a set endpoint
mm-hmm.
is antithetical to everything I believe about education
mm-hmm.
and about college in particular.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine who's a designer and writes about art, she distinguishes between design thinking, where you're trying to get from A to B,
mm-hmm.
and art thinking,
mm-hmm.
which is an open-ended process, and you
mm-hmm.
discover the endpoint.
Uh-huh.
And it's pretty clear to me that that's what education should be.
Yeah. It's really striking. I completely agree with you. But it's fascinating to me that we have, in very close juxtaposition, these two very different ideas about American higher education. One, very workforce directed, although Jamie would say what he cares about are the students, and the students being able to be assured of a good economic future. And it's striking that both of your books were written in the aftermath of the recession. How do you think about college in relationship to career preparation?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I want to say, I mean, I think those concerns are perfectly legitimate, and students, you know, we are right to be concerned. I mean, students need to go and make a living, and what can we do about that? We can make sure that they get through college with a lot less debt or no debt or not
mm-hmm.
having to pay anything to begin with. I think a lot of the other problems, though, are problems with the way the economy is structured now. I mean, it's a winner-take-all economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's been no economic progress, and, you know, most of the economic spectrum for many...
I mean,
I don't know what a college can do about that.
Uh-huh.
It's because I believe so much in the value of a liberal arts education, and actually I believe in it as a right of citizenship,
mm-hmm.
that the students who are going to community colleges, let alone Berkeley or Yale, deserve to have, and deserve to have provided for them if they want to do it and do the work,
mm-hmm.
if they want it and want to do the work. But because I believe in it so much, I think colleges actually need to make an effort to help connect that kind of education to career. Not
uh-huh.
by distorting the education, which tends mm-hmm. to be what happens,
mm-hmm.
but by helping students, and especially students who aren't in STEM fields,
mm-hmm.
imagine futures for themselves.
Uh-huh.
Connect themselves to the job market in an active way. And I think there are different ways that colleges can do that. And I don't know of any college that's doing it particularly well.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. You talk about students in your book feeling anxious, timid, and lost, as if that's a bad thing. And I think being anxious, timid, and lost is part of growing up. And I wonder how do you connect? I mean, you're very powerful diagnosis of a lot of what's wrong in our socialization of young people towards success today, with just what is the mess and muddle of growing up, where most individuals do feel anxious, timid, and lost if they're really thinking about the issues in their lives.
I understand what you're saying, but I actually disagree. I think there's a normal kind of disorientation that it's an important developmental stage of young adulthood. Mm-hmm. And I think the anxious, timid, and lost thing is precisely because they're not being given the opportunity or the tools to go through that kind of wander years, right, that I remember going through. Mm-hmm. Because they've been inculcated with an intense risk of failure and with a sense that life is a straight path and you just jump through the hoops that the grown-ups hold up for you. Yeah. So typically what happens when they get to the end of college is they either look for more hoops, which is a lot of what going to Wall Street is about, or law school or medical school, or they're really lost but without the kinds of tools to go through those first few years after college and, you know, be depressed and be confused. And that's sort of normal, but they actually don't have that. And that's why we see these mental health statistics really changing. I mean, if we didn't have that to rely on, we could say this is just normal. But I don't think, and the psychologists who write about this, Madeline Levine and other people, this is something different, and it's not the healthy thing.
Mm-hmm. I was really interested in your arguments about risk in the book, and I'm fascinated by the question of how you build risk into a college education. So there was an alumna at Smith who felt very strongly about risk and actually gave Smith an endowment to bring somebody to the college who would talk about risk. And she said, I don't mean business risk. Mm-hmm. I mean risk in your personal life. And so the first people we brought for this, you know, kind of residency were three sisters who had come to Smith. And we found out in the course of this residency that their father, each of them took great risks in their personal lives to great consequence. Their father made them all, as they were growing up, jump off the garage roof to teach them risk. Now, I'm not suggesting jumping off the garage roof.
Although it might not be a bad idea.
But how can you build risk into an education in a culture that places such a there's such a strong aversion to failure with it.
It's a good question, and I want to stipulate that as someone else said, my business is complaining, not answers. And I'm not particularly good. I have no practice in policy design. But I will say that I went back to the classroom this spring. I taught a writing class at Scripps College. Uh-huh. And I was dealing with students who were perfectionists, and mm-hmm. this was a writing class, and the first thing I said to them is, it's not possible to do perfect work, so don't even worry about it. Yeah. And some of them struggled the whole semester with that. And I also borrowed something that they do at Reed, mm-hmm. which is that they give students grades, but they don't tell them what they are, which was great. Mm-hmm. It was great for about two-thirds of the semester, and then the last third of the semester, like the absence of those electric shocks at regular intervals kind of reduced the motivation of some of the students. But it freed them to take chances because they didn't have that immediate feedback.
Yeah.
So, I mean, those are a couple of things that we can implement. I mean, part of what I'm saying is that I think it's a lot of this is like the texture of the classroom.
Yes.
And what's the reward system, and what do the assignments look like? I mean, open-ended assignments that don't get graded or don't have right or wrong answers. Mm-hmm. I mean, people have been talking about this in a number of different connections for a while anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, so much of these problems are systemic, and any one person even a university president is really constrained by what they can do. So if it's a job market that only looks at people with perfect GPAs or law schools, what can you say?
Yeah, that's really interesting. The conversations that I've had in the course of my career with people who hire say they're not interested in GPAs. They're interested in passion and risk taking. So maybe that's an important message.
Well, I think there's a whole set of messages to get to these students. And one of them is it doesn't matter what you major in.
Yeah, right.
But the problem is you can say this 100 times. Mm-hmm. You can tie them down and shout it at them, and they can't hear it.
Yeah.
And I often end up in conversations with people in your kind of position saying, you know, we're tearing our hair out. Like, we know these things and we can't communicate it to students and their parents.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to keep trying, or maybe we need to do it in different ways, or maybe we need to get business leaders more involved in delivering that message, because obviously we have no credibility to deliver it. No, I mean, we don't. I mean,
I think that's right. I mean, you tell to students that, but with the other, your other hand, you're grading them on their assignments and you're turning your grades in. So it's
that's true. But I also meant, like, we're not doing the hiring, so they're not going to believe a bunch of professors.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
And the hiring we do is very meritocratic.
Yes, we could talk about excellent sheep in a different connection.
Yes, but, that's right. That's true. So you say that housing a liberal arts college in a research university is untenable, but that's what we have. And so how do you make the best of what you say is untenable?
Right. I mean, that's that sort of structural contradiction in American higher education. Yeah. I think that we really need to get serious about either having a parallel teaching faculty that has every bit as much institutional prestige, same rank, same salary, same administrative power as a research faculty, or some kind of combination, either or. You know, places talk about it, but I've never heard of any place that really has done that.
So
what do you think? You think a chance that that could happen?
I wish it would, because I think that would be a good solution to what Clark Kerr also identified as a structural problem within these multiversities that we've created.
Look, and what's happened is that we now have the full-time non-tenure track is now a third. Not adjuncts, not graduate students, full-time non-tenure.
Yeah.
I'm sure you've got a lot of them here. They are, in effect, a teaching faculty.
Yeah.
But they don't have equal status and wealth, or job, let alone job security. They don't have tenure by definition.
Yeah.
So, in other words, it's evolved, but it's kind of evolved in the back door and not in a satisfactory way.
Yeah. So there was, I don't know, some of you may have seen this, too. There was a column that appeared in yesterday's New York Times by David Brooks called The Big University. And he has a bunch of recommendations, which most of which I think you would be sympathetic to. In fact, I wondered whether he had read your book and that it was using that as material for his column. But one thing he said that really struck me, he's quoting a passage from Nietzsche. Actually, he's quoting Maria Popova, who's quoting a passage from Nietzsche. Let the young soul survey its own life with a view of the following question. What have you truly loved thus far? What has ever uplifted your soul? What has dominated and delighted it at the same time? And he talks about college as about falling in love. And I wonder if you could just talk about that a little bit, whether you think that that's a good way of describing college.
It is, but I'm also wary of it. And my biggest chapter is about how you sort of find that thing. And I'm careful and self-conscious about what we call that thing. Passion is a complete cliche now. I think purpose is a better word. You can that cliche of just do what you love. First of all, we shouldn't get focused on any single word. And it can misguide students. I don't know how to find my passion. I don't just have one passion, I feel terrible, even more stressed because I have to find my passion. I have to find it by the time I get out of college. But also, this gets back to the realities of the job market. Yeah. And I think we need to be clear. There's a really good book that just came out that I think is called Do What You Love and Other Lies About the Modern Economy. You can't just do what you love. You have to make a compromise. But I do think you need to start from whatever we want to call that and try to bring the reality, your economic reality, as close to that as possible. And also, we shouldn't talk as if, college is the end point, the beginning and the end of the process. It's the beginning of the process. I mean, I think typically, you kind of spend your 20s figuring it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, as long as we stay in that ballpark without holding on to those particular words. But then how do we do that? I mean, listen, are professors trained to help students do this? Are universities set up to help students? I mean, this is kind of, I want to hear from the audience, but, universities are designed to teach, to teach people how to make arguments in psychology, to teach people how to make arguments in biology or English lit. But there are all these developmental goals, and then there are also all these economic goals that somehow need to get shoehorned into what's actually a very specific kind of process. And I think that's one of the reasons for the growth of administration. I mean, there are all kinds of bad reasons, but like we're trying to retrofit all these other things into an institution that's designed to, people who are experts in psychology teaching students how to think like a psychologist.
Yeah, but you say in your book, I mean, in a wonderful chapter, the one about spirit guides, that the way in which faculty teach this is by themselves embodying it and showing students their passions. And that certainly was true of me. It was seeing this teacher that I had as a freshman in college being passionate about Victorian literature as if it was something that changed your soul. And that's what made me a Victorianist. But what you say reminds me, when I was president of Smith, a student who was a senior came to me in my office, and she was so worried. And she said, "Everybody says find your passion, but I don't have a passion." And it was like she flunked passion. I mean, it was really... my final question, then I'll throw it open to the audience, is about elitism. So the colleges that are subject of your book educate a tiny proportion of American students. And 50% of our students are in community colleges. And I wonder whether, this is a quite challenging question, whether your book makes those institutions, many people in higher education now are saying we focus too much on elite institutions in the conversation about higher education, and focusing our research, focusing our discourse, focusing our writing on elite institutions makes students, the majority of students, in other kinds of institutions less visible. And so one of the things that I kept wondering as I was reading your book is whether your book, in even in its making the critique of elitism, is helping support elitism in saying these are the institutions that count. I realize this is a very fundamental question.
No, listen. I mean, it's been said that the New York Times mentions Harvard more than it mentions all community colleges put together. Like somebody, went and counted.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree with that. But I didn't set out to write a book about higher education.
Yeah.
I didn't set out to write a book at all. I wrote a book about the world that I knew and the students that I knew and what I thought they needed to hear.
Yeah.
And I don't pretend to have done anything other than that. And I know that I'm addressing a small percentage. Yeah. I think it matters for everybody because they're the ones who end up running the world. And also, it's actually, I mean, it ends up, there's been an estimate that like 10 to 15% of American high school graduates get caught up in the selective admissions process, even if a smaller percentage end up at the top 12 schools. So it's not a small number of kids. But I absolutely agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the book I wrote or really even the book that I could write. I do say at the end, listen, what we really need is not to make the Ivies more accessible or better, but to make them, I don't know if I use the word, but to make them obsolescent. They shouldn't be as important, and they wouldn't be as important if people could go, if there were five Berkeleys in every state, and it was Berkeley back in the day when it was free, and students could graduate on time because they had enough classes.
Yeah.
There would be much less pressure for everybody to try to get into the same 12 schools.
Yeah, good. Thank you. Well, let me throw it open to you for questions. Yes?
I'm curious what your thoughts are on student evaluations.
I don't have a well-developed idea about them.
Excuse me, the question is on
student
evaluations.
Do you want me to add a couple clauses? Or
it would help me get a sense of...
Listening to you talking about, how professors might teach in a room and how to maybe find another way to teach seems to me to be folded into the idea of student evaluations when they are important. For employment, it is for teaching faculty.
Right.
And so if you fear teaching new techniques because the student evaluation is feeding back expecting a standard technique, then you're not going to go forward. And if the students aren't educated in celebrating new techniques, they're going to, because they don't know how to evaluate either, they're going to evaluate by some standard method. And so you get this sort of locked-in system.
Right. No, I mean, as I understand, the student evaluations are almost the only feedback that employers get on teacher performance. And I think that's ridiculous. But it would take more resources. You'd need to go and observe, and then maybe you need to help mentor teachers. I agree. I mean, for tenure track people, they mean almost nothing. And for people who aren't in the tenure track, they mean way too much. And, Mark Edmondson talks about how, the one time his students sit up straight is at the end because they know how to write a customer evaluation, right? And they tell him that he's been entertaining, and that's good.
Yeah, Sean.
Why
don't you stand up when you ask your question so your voice projects?
Sure. I haven't read your book, but I read your excellent piece in Harper's. And it's just a few of the comments you've made today, I think, actually can be addressed rather directly. So it turns out there are actually 15 free Berkeleys in every state. In fact, there are 15 free Berkeleys in every county in the world if you've got an internet connection. Because Berkeley is actually, through edX, has put a lot of its courses online. So I dread to say this in Berkeley, but the Wall Street Journal had a really good article on Monday, again, about Marco Rubio's comment that accreditation has just basically become a scam. And that essentially accreditation has actually led to what you correctly point out, monetization of students. So somebody who takes 40 Berkeley credits in Bangladesh and does superbly will not really be as employable as somebody who takes the same 40 credits does not as well here, because of the what Rubio, I think, correctly refers to as the accreditation scam. So the issue which is underlying this is there not actually a case that the solution is out there already? It's just basically a matter of really the powers that be readjusting to actually allow quality come through from all over the world.
I appreciate the spirit in which you asked the question, but I actually do disagree. The notion that online courses can replace traditional classroom instruction, I think, is not only misguided, but has been shown to be misguided. Very few people finish those courses, and most of the ones who finish them already have college degrees, because you need to teach yourself. I mean, you need to learn how to teach yourself, and that's ultimately what college is doing. And then once you've done that, you can take online courses. That's why I don't I don't know of anyone who's actually claimed, certainly anyone who actually is involved in the courses, not politicians, who's actually even claimed that they do anywhere near as good as classroom instruction. It's just that in so many places, like San Jose State, where they tried it first and it was a miserable failure, things are in such dire straits that it's sort of better than nothing, which is what a lot of students are getting now. The only online courses that have been successful are ones where what they call the mixed model, where you have actual professors or teachers in the classroom helping, but those aren't cheaper because you still need people there. So, I mean, I actually don't think it's the solution, because I don't think online instruction is ever going to be very good for a typical college student.
If I can very briefly.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
There are, in fact, other mixed models where, for example, you do the course online, but there are thousands of the underemployed postdocs and so on that are out there in the world who can actually, you can contact to get something clarified, so you actually have special attention from, and in fact, that model is actually working well.
Is it really working well?
Yeah, it is.
Because I actually met someone who does that work, and she's choosing from a number of, she has a huge amount of stuff to do, getting paid very little. She chooses from prefabricated answers. I mean, real education is an intense, intimate, one-on-one experience. I don't know how you replicate that online.
You get on Skype, but sorry, somebody else wants to ask.
But then you're not educating 100,000 people at a time, which is the whole promise of the thing.
Okay, you in front.
Yeah, well, I wanted to give...
Why don't you stand up and ask your question so people can hear?
That's right. Sorry about that. I just wanted to give a little input on the online courses talk, because I've taken a couple of online courses. I'm a transfer student, and before I transferred in, I took a couple, and I did well. But that being said, I definitely, far and away, prefer classroom instruction. And it's because even though I was getting an A in those online courses, I didn't feel like I was learning nearly as much or getting the same personal experience that you're talking about. I think that the personal relationship that you make with the professor and that you make with your colleagues cannot be replicated in an online format, even when the teacher is very good and tries their best to replicate it. So I just wanted to throw that out there. And I also just wanted to ask a question. I'm an English and philosophy double major, and so I get quite a bit of flack from people about the practicality of that and the employability of that. And when you said, you know, your major doesn't matter and you want to shout that at people, could I get a little bit more explanation? Because everybody's making me feel like my major really matters and that it's not usually good enough. So
I have about 5 pages on that in the book, and I actually, it's actually the one part of the book that's like really redundant and repetitive because I want to hammer it home. It's the beginning of chapter 8. Wall Street Journal survey of over 300 employers, your college major is a minor issue. That's what the head, and because employers are looking for skills, and they're looking for a lot of the skills they're looking for are the kinds of skills that liberal arts majors as opposed to technical majors instill. I mean, we could talk about this more, you know, privately, but I mean, you know, communication skills, problem-solving skills, working in teams. Everybody knows that technical majors make more straight out of college. Very few people know that that gap almost entirely disappears within 10 years. Yeah, exactly. This is the kind of thing you can try to tell. There was a great piece a few years ago, not too many years ago, there was a great piece, I think, in the New Republic, where they talked about, you know, liberal arts major, they quoted other articles about how liberal arts major X is working as a barista, you know, and then they revealed that actually the article is 40 years old, because this is a periodic sort of, it's like a recurrent disease in American journalism that they rediscover this story, and at the end of the article, the guy had tracked down the people mentioned in the article in Newsweek in the 70s, and they all had great careers and, you know, various different things, because it equips you for a career and not just for your first job.
Okay, the man in the green sweater.
Hey, I am currently one of the faculty you were talking about, so a non-tenured.
Oh, yeah.
In the chemistry department. I went to Pomona College for undergrad and then I came here for graduate school, so most of your book, I was like, oh, I want to fight you and then I want to praise you at the same time.
Okay.
Talk about my people. Those are my people.
Right.
Mostly, as a chemistry teacher, you had a chapter about humanities and saying that the humanities are a great way to learn critical thinking about yourself and about everything else. And I was just wondering, don't the sciences also teach critical thinking? And why it sort of felt, I just want to get your take on if you think the sciences are doing the right amount of critical thinking, or if at the elite schools they're teaching it differently, or if we need to somehow combine...
No, let me be very clear about this. And I want to also say that I was a science major. My dad was an engineering professor. I talk about the liberal arts, and I tell people the liberal arts means sciences and social sciences and humanities, and they're those fields where you learn critical thinking. And then I talk about why liberal arts majors are employable. And then I pivot and I say, but when it comes to the introspective aspect of a college education, that's where the humanities, I do believe, and I'm not the only one, play a unique role. I'm thinking of Harry Lewis, the computer science professor who's dean of Harvard College, and he says we need to acknowledge that some subjects are more central to a college education than others, and he's talking about the humanities. So that's what I mean. It's not about critical thinking. It's about critical thinking about yourself.
Yes, in the white sweater. You.
Oh.
Yeah. Stand up.
Well, first I wanted to say I saw something on the internet not too long ago that listed various famous people and what their college major was. And it was, you know, it was probably the best way to make the point that it really doesn't matter.
Jerry Brown's major was classics right here at Berkeley.
But I was wondering if your book addresses the kind of student who, by the time she's, you know, 16 or even younger, knows exactly what she wants to do with her life, knows she wants to be a doctor or a lawyer or an English professor.
Right.
Would you steer somebody like that away from, you know, intensively going through the hoops that are required for that career?
Right. That's a good question. What I would say was, and I think this kind of one-on-one mentorship is exactly the kind of thing that professors should be providing for students. Where is that desire coming from? Is it a genuine desire, or is it somehow something that she got from her parents? I would encourage her to be at least to be open at least when she first gets to college to other possibilities. But if it seems like a genuine thing, I would say, you know, take advantage of the fact that you can have a broad curriculum here. But, you know, I'm not against it per se. I'm against the way I see so many students arriving at that kind of decision.
Yes.
I think a lot what you speak to is in the elite education is this privileged bubble of white upper class of like elites talking about this whole discourse in academics. And I'm wondering if there are places where I should be looking outside of that bubble so I'm not like readings and writings about this sort of topic. so I'm not just reading the same articles by
white guys like me.
Rich white guys. Like me. I think it's really important. Like, people of color, marginalized communities, women as well. Like, where should I be looking as opposed to like this whole. What I said.
Yeah. I'm a white guy, so I'm really not sure. And believe me, I understand that I wrote a book about white people or white people and Asian people, upper middle class. Again, I mean, that's the book that I had to write. I don't know. I wish I could tell you, but I don't know. I also suspect that that discourse that you're looking for is probably about other things. I quote a lot of conservatives in the book, which kind of drives me crazy, like David Brooks, and I know, I hated that. But I didn't know of anyone, or very few people, never mind not white, not conservative, because it seems to be only like traditional conservatives, not even neoconservatives, who care about this, who like talk about liberal education anymore. It's become a dirty word for a lot of people. So,
you quote N plus one. In like an interview I was reading about you, and I think it's like N plus one is awesome, but at the same time, it's again like
white right, guys.
One small class, and
right.
I'm wondering if there are other magazines or literary journals and things that I can be looking at, or undergrads, or.
I know the New Criterion. No, I always say that wrong. The New Inquiry. Makes a point of being very diverse in its authorship. I don't know how much they've written about higher education. I was going to say something else and I forgot.
John.
Right. One thing that you didn't talk about, and maybe it's not in your book, is democracy. The only time that I've experienced, I've been in this game for 50 years. The only time that I saw real movement was in the 1960s and 1970s. And the reason was not that professors had anything new to say. It was because new actors and agents were on the scene. So what would happen if first we democratize the faculty, we allow a full voting membership for every single person who teaches on this campus, and secondly, we bring back a student input that is not a sham, but is real, and thereby empower students, get them out of this timidity mode to speak up and speak out and ask for what they need, because that's essentially the point of your book. What would happen?
I don't know what would happen, but I think that's exactly what we need to do. You're right, I don't talk about it. I hadn't really developed my thoughts about it. But students have, you know, now what I say to students is you need to organize. And I'm going to say it later today. You need to organize, you know, one person is ignorable. You need as a group to tell the university, take advantage of the fact that schools now treat their students like customers and act like that, and then they will respond. I think those are both great suggestions. And the part about democratizing the faculty, I hadn't heard that one before. That's terrific.
It's
put a
free.
Scare into the tenure. Okay.
Yes.
I wanted to return to the question of does it make a difference in what you major? I've been out of the business now, retired for some years, but I do remember some studies some time ago where, yes, the CEOs of companies, banks, other manufacturing companies said, yes, what we want are broadly trained people, critical thinking, liberal arts education. But they weren't doing the hiring. And what they found out was that the people in the HR offices who were actually doing the hiring were the ones who were checking the boxes, major, grades, so on and so forth. So after 10 years or so, and once you get in, you can work your way around this. And so they may end up late, in a better position later on. But I think the concern about the double major in philosophy and English is the barrier comes when you first walk in with your resume and you meet the HR person who has no interest in the liberal arts whatsoever.
Sorry.
I'm used to it.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. Hi, so my experience teaching on the campus, there are far more students who are apathetic than are nervous in this way that you talk about, that are obsessed. And so is this another aspect of the problem, or is this just a separate thing that you're not? I mean, you know, I can fail people and they never should, you know, it's like no matter what you do, you can't get a it's a minority, but it's more than the people that you describe this campus.
Well,
they don't contact you under any circumstance. No matter, you know, you could fail them and you just never see them.
Yeah, I mean, this sounds like a different set of issues that have to do with a different, very different institutional type. But it's also about, listen, this is about engagement, right? This is about half the people who start college in America don't finish. And it's also about online education. I mean, this is, I think, another reason why online education is such a desperate mistake. Because we actually need to put the most resources into students who first come to campus.
Patrick.
Oh, sure. My name's Patrick Clappett. I'm a grad student in economics. I actually did an engineering major, and I know you criticized those more professional majors. But I was also a social major, too. So my question is, I know we've talked about faculty and we talked about students, but I know the growth of administration and staff has been a big role. And for a lot of students, especially like first-generation students, usually like these staff resources are who they remember getting them through the university and such. But I guess, what is the role of staff in either perpetuating some of this, or from your experience, or in making it also change, or being involved in government, in moral governance as well?
Let me first say that I'm not against any particular major. I'm against what's driving students into certain majors.
Economics is not a tool, but it's like how it can be used.
But I haven't thought a lot about your second question. Except that I don't have this automatic negative reaction about the growth of administrative bloat. I mean, I think it's a problem, but I also recognize, as you just said, that there are actually good reasons for a lot of these administrators to do all the things that professors can't do for students, including helping engage the new populations that have come into the universities in the last few decades. I don't see that as related to my set of issues at all, to be quite frank, because I think it's more a factor at sort of more public universities with a more diverse group of students. But I mean, experiments that they've done at Arizona State about trying to keep students engaged, we were just talking about engagement, having people really track and check in and make sure that they're not falling through the cracks, I think are really important. And if they mean that we have to hire more administrators, fine.
Okay, we have time for two more questions. You in the front and you in the back.
So I just wanted to talk about sort of your response to him and sort of the talk, the last question the moderator asked about sort of the sort of white male elitism of this sort of notion of liberal arts education in these elite schools. And as you said, I mean, I don't really think that it's a good enough excuse to say I'm a white guy, so I don't have a lot of perspectives of people of color. But I'm wondering, is this sort of model that's been crafted by these neoconservative, white, like elite men really sustainable? And how do we, and does this liberal arts education model change? And how is it sort of affected as we bring in a lot of diverse voices and perspectives? Because I think that for me, at least in my first year and a half at Berkeley, is really what liberal arts has meant, is being exposed to all of these diverse perspectives. And it seems like maybe you're trying to rediscover something that was lost in the 1700s or the 1800s, but I guess I'm wondering how do we, like, I think we're living in a very different world, and how do we incorporate these voices that maybe we're not hearing in this university into what, maybe not even rediscover an old thing, but craft, I guess, a new liberal arts education.
So here's the thing. I mean, what you're asking a question that I get a lot, which is, this liberal arts thing was just the WASP aristocrats of the 19th century, and it's become totally irrelevant, and it's 200 years out of date. Historically, that's completely untrue. And if you trace the history of American higher education, you find out that as we increased access, starting during the Civil War, right, first country to ever do anything like this, and we expanded higher ed out from the rich white boys, and eventually institutions went co-ed and instituted affirmative action, and we had the GI Bill, and we had the three-tiered system at the University of California. The notion of a liberal education was integral throughout that entire process. It wasn't just about training people for a workforce. It was about educating new groups into citizenship. This was the governing rubric. And I don't see anything that's white or male about that project. And in fact, it also involved, ultimately, a great influx of new voices into the humanities. And this is what the culture wars were about in the 70s and 80s. What we didn't realize in the 70s and 80s when we were fighting the culture wars was that the whole thing would become irrelevant, because the very grounds on which those wars were fought, humanities departments, would be destroyed by neoliberalism. That's the problem. Let's have these arguments. Absolutely.
But my question is you answered his question. You said that you don't really know a lot of sort of people from these diverse backgrounds in higher education writing on this issue as much. And so I'm wondering, like, if they're writing about different issues, like, there's a reason that they're writing about other issues, and sort of how do we incorporate the real concerns they have about those things into our model of a liberal arts education. It's not about, like, I think that we should just, like, educate people for the workforce. It's that there are these other intense concerns out there that we're sort of coming to because we're the faculty, like, it's not sort of completely diverse yet, but we're diversifying, and I think that there are these real concerns that a lot of groups
But
have
here's there. The thing. I think this is what I'm trying to say. Just as the American democratic system, from the beginning, even though it excluded women and slaves, right, was a structure that could be and ultimately was expanded to include all adult citizens and their voices, liberal education is the same. It contains the potential and has proven that it has the potential, because it's not about one thing. It's about talking about these issues from whatever perspective you're coming from. And it proved itself open. I mean, not as open as it should be. The problem is that whole idea now is being judged irrelevant and impractical. And universities and governors and countries want to do away with the very institutional structure that permits it to happen in the first place. No American studies departments anymore. No English departments anymore. You can study econ, you can study engineering. You want to have these kinds of conversations, go somewhere else. That's what I'm saying. Now, maybe I can see that that's not an adequate response to you, but that's my response.
I guess it just feels like you have a bit of an obligation to sort of include these other concerns in your discussion. That's sort of
okay. Question. I'm going to move on since our time is up to one last question.
So my husband and I are here as parents of eighth graders. So we're starting, I mean, the fact that we're here worrying about it now when we've got 13-year-olds. both of us are products of public universities, either Cal or University of Illinois. We would love our kids to be able to get into Berkeley or Illinois. They might be able to if they get a 4.2 GPA, they play a varsity sport, they did 40 hours of community service in addition to their school, right? So here we are as 13-year-olds, or they are as 13-year-olds. How are we even going to get the kind of education? Because quite frankly, with all due respect, I don't want them to go to Chico State. I want them to go, but they don't need to go to Harvard or Yale, but I want them to go to a well-rounded school, liberal arts or whatever, but how do we even get them there?
And then you have to pay for it, too. No, I know. I mean, I wish I had a good answer for you. I don't have a good answer. I mean, this is the problem, right? This is the problem with the system.
Well, let's thank you for it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.